everything that counsel covered in the last discussion. And so if Your Honor has questions about any of the other claims or anything else, I'm happy to answer. The court. I have more questions, but not on that point. Mr. Spiva. Okay. The court. We're going to go into the pleadings and then into the class action allegations. But I think what we'll do is to give the court reporter a break. We'll take a short recess, and then we'll come back and conclude with my questions into those areas, and then any additional comments that either side wishes to bring to the court's attention. Mr. Spiva. Great. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. All right. Let's have everyone back in here at, let's say, 5 after by the courtroom clock. Court's in recess. Courtroom security officer. All rise. The judge exited the courtroom. Recess taken at 2:50 p.m. until 3:06 p.m. The judge entered the courtroom. The court. Please be seated. We have 2 remaining areas to cover, the pleadings and then the class action allegations. And some of the comments that you've already made will have already touched upon some of the questions that I'm going to ask, but I want to ask them in any event so that we have a complete record. And for the defense. Mr. Spiva. Okay. The court. Having filed a previous Rule 12b motion, does Rule 12g bar the defense from filing a successive Rule 12b motion? Mr. Spiva. No, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. The court. And take your time. There's no rush. There's no rush. Mr. Spiva. Okay. Thank you. First of all, 12g2, Your Honor, Rule 12g2, which is the rule that plaintiffs cite for waiver here, doesn't apply to a 12b1 motion. I think they concede that, the subject matter jurisdiction. With respect to the 12b6 motion, it actually doesn't apply to that either. It refers to 12b2 through 5. And here, we asked for more time to raise 12b6 issues in the motion to quash that we filed, and the plaintiffs raised no objection at that time that we would have waived the 12b6 motion based on a failure to state a claim. And there's really, I think, no question that we could raise the same arguments in a 12c motion for judgment after the answer. And so, I think this would, even if the rule did apply here, this would be one of those cases. And I think one of the cases we cited was Care Logistics and some other cases in our brief, where it really wouldn't make any sense. I mean, it kind of cuts against the purpose of the rule, which is where you're trying to prevent piecemeal litigation of defenses. After the defendant loses one, they bring another. That's not what has happened here, Your Honor. You know, we weren't properly served. We offered to accept service of process. The plaintiffs refused to do that. And so we were forced to file the motion. We actually won the motion. They refiled. And here, you know, really this is the first kind of, I think, first time at bat, if you will, Your Honor, in terms of the 12b6 merits type issues. And given that we could raise those in a 12c motion, it really doesn't seem like it would serve any kind of judicial efficiency interests to not consider those arguments if the court gets to them. I mean, of course, our position is that because there's no subject matter jurisdiction, the court won't need to reach those issues. The court. If the court concludes that Rule 12g prevents the defense from making their failure to state a claim arguments in the motion to dismiss, does the defense anticipate that they will file a Rule 12c motion? Mr. Spiva. Yes, Your Honor. I mean, assuming that the court didn't dismiss everything based on the 12-1 through 12b-1 portion of the motion. The court. All right. Thank you. Any comments from the plaintiff? Take your time. Mr. Beck. Thank you, Your Honor. I think in response to the court's questions on the effect of Rule 12g-2, I think for us it's really a simple question of what the rule states. And when you look at 12g-2, the court, clearly permits them to raise subject matter jurisdiction in a successive motion under Rule 12. But it states that you may not raise other issues, including Rule 12b-6 issues, if you fail to raise those in your original motion. I'm not sure why the defendant making a request for additional time to raise such issues in connection with its original motion would do anything to alter the plain language and the plain effect of the rule. I think the rule makes a lot of sense, and it gives the defendant an option, which it's already said it's planning to take, avail itself of, should the court, were the court, find the rule to preclude them from raising these issues now. But it gives them an option to file a motion for judgment on the pleadings, which is, I think makes perfect sense. These are very significant issues that have been placed in front of the court. The law surrounding these issues is not uncomplex. And so I think when you put so many big-picture arguments in one motion at a time, and you're trying to argue subject matter jurisdiction, and at the same time you're arguing failure to state a cause of action, at the same time you're arguing motion to strike class certification, you know, it perhaps doesn't crystallize the issues as well as they could be. So, if the defendants had wanted to bring these issues with the Rule 12 motion, they had every opportunity when they filed their motion to dismiss based on service of process. They failed to do so. The rule is very clear what happens in that circumstance. It allows them to raise subject matter jurisdiction issues, but it doesn't allow them to raise 12b-6 issues. And it gives them an option to do so in the context of a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And based on what the rule says, we think that's what ought to happen. Thank you. The court. All right. Let me ask the plaintiff, with respect to questions regarding the pleadings, as you've just stated. The plaintiffs contend that the defendant's failure to state a claim arguments are barred by Rule 12G's consolidation requirements. If the defendants may simply raise these arguments again in a Rule 12C motion, what is the expedience of avoiding those issues now? Mr. Beck. Well, I don't think it's just a matter... I don't know that expedience is the only consideration behind that rule. Certainly that's always a value and a consideration that ought to be taken into account in judicial labor, and we understand that. But a motion for judgment on the pleadings is predicated on them answering to the allegations in the complaint. And so should they go ahead and file a motion for judgment on the pleadings, as the rule specifically directs that they do, the court will have a fundamentally different record in front of it. It will have not just the first amended complaint, but it will also have, presumably, an answer and affirmative defenses. And without knowing how the DNC and the Congresswoman are going to answer the allegations in the complaint, I think it may be a little difficult to foresee how the issues might come up, differently in a judgment on the pleadings, but they certainly could. And because that's what the rule specifically refers to, I have to think that there's some intent behind how that rule's written to promote a value that's not just expediency, but having a fuller record in front of the court, when, in fact, the defendants could have raised those arguments on their first motion and they chose not to. The court. If the court proceeds to consider the defense's failure to state a claim arguments, how would the plaintiff be prejudiced at this time? Mr. Beck. Well, I don't think that we would be specifically prejudiced at this time. I think the only issue would be that the rule states what it states. But as to... I feel comfortable that we've briefed the issues in a way that doesn't prejudice us, and that we've had certainly a hearing today on the issues. So I don't think we would take the position that we're prejudiced. The court. All right. With respect to paragraph numbers 188 and 195 of your first amended complaint, and again, take your time. Mr. Beck. Yes, I've got them in front of me. The court. What factual allegations support the legal conclusions set forth in those paragraphs? Mr. Beck. Right. The court. That the plaintiffs relied on various statements made by the defendants. Mr. Beck. All right. So, in terms of the factual allegations that are incorporated into each of those counts, the court, and again, and I apologize for interrupting you, but without reading them into the record, we are all mindful of the Rule 9b pleading requirements. Mr. Beck. Understood. The court. Go ahead, counsel. Mr. Beck. Understood, Your Honor. I think that the allegations that support reliance in this case are the only allegations in the complaint, which pertain to the plaintiffs, really the only activities in the complaint that they are alleged to have done, which is to have contributed money to a presidential campaign. So the first part of my response would be to direct the court to paragraphs 2 through 109, which in each of those paragraphs, the plaintiff is named, the residence is given, and then the only activity that any of these plaintiffs is alleged to have done is stated, which is the contribution of a specified amount of money either to the Bernie Sanders campaign or to the DNC. So that can only be the activity that the plaintiffs undertook as part of the reliance element in those two counts, because it's their only activity in the complaint. And I think the only fair reading of the complaint is that that is the activity. In terms of what the plaintiffs relied on in paying those sums of money, I would direct the court to the paragraphs starting with paragraph 159, which describes the DNC's charter and quotes it, and then goes on to describe the various specific statements in the media that were made by various officials of the DNC, including the Congresswoman, which repeat what the charter says in terms of the DNC's commitment by its own charter to running the process in a fair and even-handed manner. And again, there is no other category of misrepresentations that's alleged in the complaint. And we've also alleged that the deception occurred by way of omission. So, we don't believe that we have to prove that any particular plaintiff relied on the specific statement cited, but because this was conduct occurring behind the scenes, not publicly disclosed by the DNC until their computers were accessed or information leaked out into the public domain, and it became known how the DNC was actually running the nominating process contrary to its charter, contrary to its public statements, that is an adequately alleged omission that the plaintiffs relied on. In other words, the failure to state that the democratic process was not in fact democratic, but biased and predetermined from the beginning for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. The court. Where does the complaint allege that the defendants intended to gain as a result of their alleged fraud? Mr. Beck. I think the first paragraph, which alleges, that is paragraph 187, which is that the defendants intended that the false statements and omissions would induce the DNC donor class plaintiffs and Sanders donor class plaintiffs to rely on them. And that allegation is substantially repeated in paragraph 194, under the negligent misrepresentation count. I think we've also alleged that in connection with other counts, what we've alleged in paragraph 204, that the conduct was intentional, willful, wanton, and malicious. We've done the same in paragraph 210 of the complaint under the unjust enrichment count. We've also alleged substantially the same in paragraph 216 for the breach of fiduciary duty count. The court. You're saying that those paragraphs that you have just referenced to the court support the legal conclusions in paragraphs 187 and 194. Mr. Beck. I think they do support those. I would also direct the court back into the factual corpus of the complaint. The court. Because that was going to be my next question. Well, let me just ask. Mr. Beck. Yes. The court. The question. What factual allegations support the legal conclusions in paragraph numbers 187 and 194 of the first amended complaint? That the defendants intentionally induced plaintiffs to donate to the Sanders campaign and to the DNC. Mr. Beck. Right. I think that those allegations are supported starting at paragraph 161 and going on through paragraph 171. And these are getting to the issues and the allegations of what exactly the DNC did in violation of the charter and the commitment to neutrality. And essentially, these paragraphs set forth that the DNC was biased in favor of one candidate, that the DNC was devoted to supporting Clinton's candidacy over everybody else's candidacy, including Senator Sanders, and that the DNC actively concealed its bias from its own donors, as well as the donors to the Sanders campaign. And I think the concealment comes from the public statements that were made by the Congresswoman and other officials of the DNC, which created a media narrative that the DNC was following the terms of its charter when in fact this was not the case. And so, in terms of the allegations of, you know, whether the intentionality here, I think the intentionality is an inference from the fact of the support for Senator Clinton. In other words, that the DNC was going to, I'm sorry, the DNC was going to do whatever it could to advance and predetermine the nomination for Hillary Clinton, while at the same time maintaining the fiction that it was operating in a fair and even-handed manner. If I could take just one moment and confer with counsel, the court. Go right ahead. Mr. Beck. Okay, thank you. The court. Take your time. Feel free to do so. Mr. Beck. Thank you. Discussion had off the record between counsel. The court. Take your time. Mr. Beck. So, I think those allegations going to what exactly the DNC was doing for the Hillary Clinton campaign behind the scenes, how it was working with the Hillary Clinton campaign, this was all part of a preset strategy that was set down in various internal documents that have come to light through Guccifer, which, obviously, that's the basis for our complaint. There have been leaks that have come out since the complaint was put on file, but I think they all show the same thing, which is an intentional, predetermined strategy to advance Hillary Clinton's candidacy to the nomination. And in terms of satisfying the element of intent for those claims, I think those allegations support that. The court. All right, thank you. My next question is, how is donating to a political campaign considered a consumer transaction under the District of Columbia law? Mr. Beck. Your Honor, the District of Columbia law in question is a broad consumer statute, which defines its terms in a very broad manner to protect individuals in the purchase of goods and services. To quote one recent case from the D.C. Superior Court, the purpose of the D.C. Consumer Protection Procedures Act is to protect consumers from a broad spectrum of unscrupulous practices by merchant. Therefore, the statute should be read broadly to assure that the purposes are carried out. Now, in terms of who may file suit under the CPPA, that is specified in the D.C. Code at Section 28-3905 sub K, which defines consumer to include any person who, quote, would purchase or receive consumer goods or services. And goods or services is defined to mean, quote, any and all part of the economic output of society at any stage or related or necessary point in the economic process. And it includes consumer credit, franchises, business opportunities, real estate transactions, and consumer services of all types. All types. And that's found in sections 28-3901 sub A2 and section 28-3091 sub A sub 7 of the DC Code. So, the plaintiffs who made their donation payments through this company called Act Blue, which we've specifically described in the complaint, those plaintiffs do qualify as consumers, we believe. And we believe they're entitled to bring suit under the CPPA. Because, as we've alleged, Act Blue charges a 3.95% fee for processing services on each donation. So, in essence, when somebody donates through Act Blue, maybe they do it on their iPhone or their computer or what have you, they are paying this percentage fee for processing. And under the terms of the statute, that makes them consumers. So then the next question becomes, if the plaintiffs are consumers, who do they have a cause of action against? And I think that in their papers, the defendants take the position that you need to have privity, some sort of privity of contract between the plaintiff and the defendant, in order to support a cause of action under the statute. And I don't think the statute, in fact, has that requirement. Obviously, we're not suing Act Blue. We're suing the DNC and Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, because that's the entity and the person that were responsible for running these primary elections, leading the process from the top. And when you look into the D.C. law on this issue, and I'm specifically referring to the case we've cited in our brief, Calvetti versus Antcliffe out of the District of Columbia Circuit 2004, which states that The CPPA liability extends to, quote, any person connected with the supply side of a consumer transaction. That's really quite broad language. Any person connected. I would say that if the transaction is deemed to be the moment when the plaintiff donates a specified sum through Act Blue, either to the Sanders campaign or the DNC, and gets charged that 3.95% fee, making them a consumer, the entity that's running the election, which encompasses the candidate to which they're donating to, is a person connected with the supply side of the consumer transaction, because they're essentially responsible for the ultimate. It's not a product. It's not a commercial transaction, but it is the end result of the money that people are paying. The supply is the political campaign, and the political campaign is ultimately under the auspices of this organization that purports to be fair and impartial. So I know that's sort of a long answer to a short question, but I think a fair reading of the statute allows us to plead a claim for those reasons. The court. And you may have just answered my next question. But what services have the DNC donors purchased from the DNC? Mr. Beck. Right. I would not say that they've purchased services from the DNC. I would say that the service that's being purchased is the processing fee that is being offered by Act Blue to consummate this political contribution transaction. So there is, I would not go so far as to say that there's a purchasing of services in the way that the statute means, but the fact that they haven't purchased services doesn't mean that the DNC and Debbie Wasserman Schultz are not persons connected with the supply side of the transaction. And for that reason, we think there's a valid cause of action under the statute. The court. My next question for the plaintiff is, what is the DNC's special relationship with registered members of the Democratic Party? Mr. Beck. Well, I think the special relationship comes down to the fact that this organization is the face of the leadership of the political party that these particular proposed plaintiffs, the Democratic Party class, have joined. That's the special relationship. I think that the New York cases that we cited showed that courts have no hesitation, at least in those cases, of finding that there's a responsibility owed from a party to its members, and it finds that this duty is sufficient to form a fiduciary duty. Admittedly, those are New York cases. They're decided under New York law. I think it's premature to engage in choice of law analysis at this stage. I'm not sure that the record is fully complete, but I do think that on the face of it, this is a D.C. corporation that's based in D.C. It would seem to me that D.C. law would apply to the question of whether what, if any, fiduciary duty is owed by the DNC to its members, the leadership of the party to the party's members. And the D.C. law on this question is, as just to quote Kemp versus Island, which is a 2015 case from the District of Columbia Circuit, District of Columbia law has deliberately left the definition of fiduciary relationship flexible so that the relationship may change to fit new circumstances in which a special relationship of trust may be properly implied. In a situation like this, the trust, I think, is that folks have joined the Democratic Party believing that the Democratic Party is a custodian of a fair and impartial election process, as it states in the DNC's own charter, and as the DNC has repeatedly, or did repeatedly state in public, according to our complaint. And I think pursuant to this particular definition of D.C. law, which I think applies here, because we're talking about a D.C. organization, this is the organization that's entrusted with the process. This is the organization that folks have registered based on the assumption that this is a democratic process that's being carried out. So, I mean, at least at the pleading stage, it seems to me to be a clear case that we've alleged enough just based on who the DNC is, who the members of the class are, to support the existence of a fiduciary relationship given the case law that we've cited. The court. And maybe you've already answered my next question, at least to a certain extent. But how is it that an entity can owe the same fiduciary duty to millions of people at the same time? Mr. Beck. Well, I think that actually, it's perhaps not as unusual as it first sounds when you think that in the context... When you consider that in the context of private corporations in the commercial world, companies have duties to their shareholders, and that's a rather uncontroversial proposition. And there's a concept that when you become a shareholder of a company, you become part of an enterprise, and the folks at the top have a duty to you when they... in terms of running the company. And I mean, in this case, I don't think it's that much of a stretch of an analogy. I mean, this may be a different market we're talking about. We're not talking about economics, we're talking about politics. But again, I think as the discussion has developed today, we strenuously take the position that just because we're talking about politics doesn't mean that the rights that exist at common law and under the D.C. statute are vitiated. And so I would say that, in answer to your question, in this case, we are talking about the political realm. But if the members of the Democratic Party are considered to be shareholders in that entity, in that political enterprise, then it seems perfectly reasonable that there would be a fiduciary duty to run the party according to what the charter itself says. That would not be unlike a situation one finds all the time with public corporations in the economic domain. The court. If registered Democrats are actually members of state Democratic parties, not the DNC itself, how is it that the DNC owes those registered Democrats a fiduciary duty? Mr. Beck. Again, I think this gets into some, perhaps some factual issues that aren't quite encompassed by the complaint at this stage. But, in terms of how the DNC exercises its command over the party, and that command trickles down through all the state parties, it seems to me that exactly how that happens, I think we... There was some discussion of it earlier between counsel for the DNC and Your Honor relating to funding. But I think the DNC does much more than that. I think it, at the end of the day, I don't think anyone is really under any illusion that the DNC runs the show in terms of the overall policy that the Democratic Party pursues at a national level. I mean, in this case, we're talking about a national election. In terms of perhaps the best analogy, is that a board of directors of a corporation owes a duty to the shareholders. The shareholders are members of a company. They're not members of the board of directors. But it's the board of directors that's running the show. So the duty does run down, because that's who's calling the shots. And I think we've pled enough in this complaint to, for one, to reasonably infer that the DNC is in fact calling the shots when it comes to the Democratic Party, if that is defined to mean all of the constituent state Democratic parties. The court. And then my last question for the plaintiff is, what is Debbie Wasserman Schultz's connection with the data breach described in the first amended complaint? Mr. Beck. With respect to that specific allegation and the claim associated with that allegation, our position is that the Congresswoman is the, at the time of the events alleged, was the leader of the DNC. It was up to her ultimately to implement policies that reasonably protected the information of the DNC's own donors. And by virtue of the data breaches occurring, she clearly failed in that responsibility. The court. All right, counsel. Thank you very much. Mr. Beck. Thank you. The court. And I'll hear from the defense with respect to those questions and answers. Mr. Spiva. All righty. The court. Take your time. Mr. Spiva. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just trying to find my place. So, I'll start back at the beginning of Your Honor's last line of questions. And I think the first one, Your Honor asked what the factual support was for paragraphs 188 and 195 of the First Amended Complaint, which set forth fraud and negligent misrepresentation allegations. And I think quite rightly, Your Honor noted that Rule 9b applies here, which is, you know, requires a detailed pleading, particular pleading specificity. As one of the cases says, the who, the how, the what, the where, the when of the alleged fraud. And there's no allegation really with respect to any of these individual plaintiffs, Your Honor, about, you know, who made a statement to them, how it defrauded them. If you look through the paragraphs that counsel directed Your Honor to, paragraphs 2 through 109, All it says is that these individual plaintiffs gave money and where they live. And it doesn't say that they've received these statements, knew about these statements, relied upon these statements. And we know that with respect to many of them, it couldn't, consistent with Rule 11. And that's a big deal, Your Honor. It's not just a simple minor pleading defect. This is a fraud allegation. And, as Your Honor noted, there's a reason why Rule 9b requires specificity. Excuse me. Specificity. And opposing counsel said that he didn't believe that they had to prove that a particular plaintiff relied on a specific statement. But that, in fact, is exactly what they would have to prove. And I think, again, shows why this certainly couldn't work as a class action. Your Honor asked where in the complaint did they allege, did the plaintiffs allege, that the defendants intended to gain as a result of the alleged fraud. And my response would be really nowhere, Your Honor. The vague and generalized allegations in paragraphs 187 and 194 don't say that the defendants intended to gain by doing this. And in terms of plausibility, Your Honor, under the Iqbal and Twombly standards, some of this, frankly, just doesn't really make logical sense. I mean, that the party tried to induce was favored Secretary Clinton, and so induced many members of the party to give to Senator Sanders. It just doesn't make logical sense, Your Honor. And there really isn't any allegation that defendants intended to gain as a result of the alleged fraud. I think Your Honor's next question was, how is donating to a political campaign a consumer transaction under the D.C. Consumer Procedure Protection Act, an act which I have some familiarity with? First of all, you know, as we quoted the language in our brief, that the D.C. CPPA defines a consumer as a person who, other than for purposes of resale, does or would purchase, lease, or receive consumer goods or services, including as a co-obligor or surety, or does or would otherwise provide the economic demand for a trade practice. It clearly doesn't apply to donating money to a political campaign. The Act goes on to define a consumer good or service as something that is used primarily for personal or household use. Clearly, donating, again, to a political campaign is not... First of all, there is no service or good that is being purchased. And second of all, certainly, even if one could somehow characterize it as a service being purchased, it's certainly not for household, primarily for household or personal use. In addition, plaintiffs tried to link this to ActBlue's commission on donations. That also doesn't really make any sense, Your Honor. You know ActBlue is not a defendant here. Certainly the DNC and certainly Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz is not a merchant under the definitions of the Act. And the fact that ActBlue charges a commission doesn't convert either of them to a merchant. And certainly you can't sue the defendants that are present in this case for something that ActBlue, it's unclear what, but ActBlue allegedly has done wrong. And keeping in mind, of course, that the plaintiffs are seeking the return of all the donations. They're not just asking for the commission that ActBlue charges. They're asking for a complete return of all the donations. So this Act just does not apply to the donations at issue here. The other issue, Your Honor, and this kind of goes back to class certification, is they're trying to apply this D.C. statute nationwide to anybody in the country, no matter what state they reside in. And that also is not proper to do. It wouldn't take a complicated choice of law analysis to say you can't apply a local state law, even if there were a consumer transaction here or a merchant involved under the Act, to consumers all over the country. We don't have consumers here. But if we did, there's no basis to do that. Your Honor asked, what services have the DNC donors purchased from the DNC? I think I just addressed that. And then moving on to the fiduciary duty, Your Honor asked, what is DNC's special relationship with the members of the party? And I would just note that the plaintiff's position on what law applies here has kind of shifted. I mean, at first the complaint doesn't really apprise the defendants of what law is being asserted here. I think we thought it was Florida law, and we addressed that in their briefing and then in their response. I think they said it was a D.C. law. And now counsel said it's too early to do that kind of a choice of law analysis. But regardless, it would not be appropriate to find a fiduciary duty here. You know, it's kind of a misnomer even to speak in terms of members of the DNC. There is no national registration. Some states don't even have a party registration. Many states, in fact. I mean, Virginia. When you register to vote, you don't register as a Democrat or a Republican or whatever. So, as far as the party's concerned, they are trying to encourage people to vote for Democratic candidates and to support Democratic policies and values. But that's not a class of people that can be defined by the court. And that changes with every election, and possibly and probably more frequently than that. That's not a situation that's akin to a shareholder of a corporation. It certainly can't, I think, under really any state's law, be the basis of some kind of a special relationship of the type that would create a fiduciary obligation. Counsel cited a D.C. Circuit case. I'll just briefly note that the D.C. Circuit actually is not the authoritative source for D.C. state law. D.C. is not a state, obviously, but there are local D.C. courts that actually are the authoritative source for what a fiduciary relationship would be under D.C. law. And the same would apply to the D.C. Consumer Procedure Protection Act. Your Honor asked, how can one entity owe fiduciary duty to millions at the same time? And I think, you know, my earlier comments, I think, went to that. I really don't think it is possible, Your Honor, with such a nebulous changing relationship, to say that there's a fiduciary duty created between the party and people who believe in democratic, you know, the values of the Democratic Party, or who vote for Democratic candidates. And I would note, because counsel for the plaintiffs said many times, well, it should be reasonable, I think, this or that about the DNC. And I just want to note that it is the plaintiff's burden here to establish that there is a fiduciary duty, and what the basis of that fiduciary duty would apply, and what law would the court look to determine that. And if they can't do that, then they can't state a claim. And they haven't. In all, I think what I just said would apply even more strongly to Congresswoman Deborah Wasserman Schultz. I keep forgetting to say each time that I'm speaking for both, Your Honor, but I certainly am. And what reminded me of that is Your Honor's next question. What is Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz's connection to the data breach described in the complaint? And really, there's no allegation of her connection to that data breach. She is mentioned in three paragraphs of the complaint, none of which address a data breach. Frankly, none of which could support any of the claims that have been brought against her. Counsel said that as the leader of the DNC, she's essentially responsible for what happened on her watch. But that would be a strict liability standard, Your Honor, and that's certainly not the case with respect to a data breach, or these types of tort claims, or contract claims for that matter, that you could say that the head of an organization, or the CEO of a corporation for that matter, can be held liable for everything that happens within that organization, or allegedly due to the actions of the organization, without specific allegations of what that person actually did to cause the alleged harm. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. All right, thank you. I have some questions for the defense. Mr. Spiva. Okay. The court. We'll go into the class action allegations at this point. With respect to the class action allegations, we'll keep in mind, obviously without reading them into the record, the threshold requirement that is required for the plaintiff to meet, and then assuming that the threshold is met, then Rule 23A and 23B come into play. But with those requirements in mind, assuming that the court rejects the defendant's standing arguments, why should the court address the class issues now, rather than waiting for a motion for class certification? Mr. Spiva. Well, I think this is the appropriate time in this case, Your Honor, for a few reasons. First, even to define really any of the three classes, but particular subclasses, but particularly with respect to the Democratic Party class, Your Honor, the court would have to invade the party's associational rights and define what it means to actually be a member of the Democratic Party. And that would also entail discovery that would invade the party's rights and the rights of the Sanders and the Clinton campaigns. Of course, the campaigns aren't themselves corporations, they're third parties. They're not parties to this litigation, but there would be discovery of both of those campaigns. and all of this would invade the First Amendment. And I think it really highlights that the class really is not ascertainable, Your Honor. And so the court should strike the allegations at this stage to save a huge amount of resources on behalf of both the parties and the court in terms of fighting these motions and the discovery that would come with that. In addition, there are problems with standing with respect to individual members of the putative class. And so even if Your Honor rejects our overarching standing argument, we would still have the right, Your Honor, to challenge each class member's standing. Did they rely on statements of the DNC? Did they even know about them? Would they have not given if they had known? Same with the Sanders subclass. Same with the third subclass. And so, millions of people have no injury. And it would require both invasive, expensive, you know, thousands if not millions, of essentially depositions. And of course, a mini-trial on each individual standing alone. The same issues, I think, come up with respect to predominance and typicality, and probably several other of the requirements under 23B. And so we submit, Your Honor, that now is the appropriate time to avoid that thicket, which would, I think, enmesh the court in a lot of political issues, would invade the First Amendment interests of certainly the defendants here. And at the end of the day, Your Honor, this is a class that is not certifiable. The reliance, and that's not the only problem, but reliance, again, is the third rail of class certification. And they can't prove that on a class-wide basis without individualized proof from every single class member, which destroys any usefulness of the class device here. The court. All right. And again, understanding that if, or assuming arguendo, that the court were to reject the defendant's standing arguments, if the court strikes the class allegations, will the court have jurisdiction over the claims in the first amended complaint? Mr. Spiva. So I'm assuming the court has rejected our standing arguments, but struck the class allegations. The court, allegations. Mr. Spiva. I mean, there's the court. Let's do it this way. Mr. Spiva. Okay. The court. If I did what I suggested. Mr. Spiva. Right. The court. The jurisdiction for the remaining claims would be based on what? Mr. Spiva. Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that there would be no jurisdiction for all the reasons that there is no standing. The reason I'm having difficulty is, if I assume you're rejecting the standing arguments with respect to the court, well, would it be based on diversity? Mr. Spiva. Oh, that is what plaintiffs have alleged, that there's diversity jurisdiction here. The court. So the question is, if I struck the class allegations, would I still have jurisdiction over the claims in the first amended complaint? Mr. Spiva. And again, I'm putting standing to one side. The court. Sure. Mr. Spiva. My first answer would be no, because of standing. But I'm not sure, Your Honor, and this is the reason. I believe that what gets them into diversity with the class allegations is CAFA. And I'm not positive, standing here at this moment, I can check, whether every single one of those putative class representatives lives outside of Florida. I'm sorry, lives outside of D.C. Because, of course, if one of the plaintiffs, the court, well, the DNC is registered in the district. Mr. Spiva, right, the District of Columbia. The court, and has its principal place of business in the district. Mr. Spiva, right, to be clear, whether every single one of the named plaintiffs, putative named plaintiffs, lives outside of the District of Columbia. Because I believe that if there is one, and I believe there is at least one, that lives in the District of Columbia, that would destroy complete diversity, and the court would not have jurisdiction. The court. All right. Go ahead. That's all right. Mr. Spiva. Okay. The court. I've got a chart here somewhere. Mr. Spiva. And I can take a quick look when I next... The court, no, that's all right. That's all right. Your argument is that if one lives in the district, the court would not have diversity jurisdiction. That's all right. Mr. Spiva, that's right. The court. Okay. Mr. Spiva. That's right, Your Honor. The other thing that I'm not sure they could meet the amount in controversy, I'm not sure that they could meet it even collectively. I mean, there are a lot of, maybe they could, because there are about 100-some people on the list, but if one lives in the District of Columbia, that would destroy complete diversity. The court. All right, thank you. Mr. Spiva. Thank you, Your Honor. The court. I'll hear from the plaintiff. Mr. Beck. Your Honor. On the issue of their motion as it pertains to the class action allegations, this is alternative relief that they sought by way of their, what they styled their motion to dismiss. And the last sentence of the defendants, the first paragraph in their motion states, quote, in the alternative, to the extent any portion of the complaint survives, the court should strike the allegations which are facially unsustainable. They don't cite a specific provision of Rule 12 in making that request to the court, but the one provision of Rule 12 that deals with anything relating to a motion to strike or a request to strike allegations is 12F. And because of that, I think my first point on this line of questions from the court is that I do believe we get back to 12G2 and the argument that they waived these arguments for the same reason that we discussed in connection with their 12B6 motion, or the aspect of their motion relating to whether we can state a cause of action. But I would add a proviso, and getting back to the court's previous question when we were addressing 12B6, the court asked, how would it prejudice us to decide those issues now? And our answer was, with respect to 12B6, we don't suggest there is any prejudice. I think the situation is somewhat different with respect to the class act allegations. I think that the 12G2 still applies, but with the addition that there is prejudice to entertaining a motion to strike class action allegations at this stage, and that this prejudice has been articulated in the case law. And we cited some cases, including cases from this district, Martorella versus Deutsche Bank, which is a Southern District case from 2013, which states that the question of class certification is generally not addressed on a motion to dismiss. There's also Gil Samuel, Phonetic, from 2014, again appearing on page 2 to page 18 of our brief, which holds that an order on a motion to strike class action allegations would, by its very nature, carry more finality and less prospective flexibility than the typical order on a class, on motion for class certification. And for that reason, the court deemed that these types of motions are contrary to the spirit of Rule 23, which allows for some flexibility, and also contemplates that there would have been an opportunity to conduct some discovery in connection with the class certification determination. So, we would submit that based on 12G2, based on the cases from this district, which disfavor ruling on a class certification motion, or defer ruling on a motion to strike class certification allegations outside of a formal motion for class certification. We submit then, in view of those two sources of authority, that it's premature to even consider the defendant's arguments at this time. That said, just to quickly address some of the points they've made. They suggest that it's impossible for us to maintain a class action in this case, because we've pled reliance, and we've pled reliance on false statements. There's a whole line of cases that certify class actions in the context of uniform omissions, and I think that ultimately this is a case that's more about omissions than specific statements of fact. Because as I think we've addressed more than a couple times throughout this hearing, the essence of the claims in this case is that folks made contributions to a political candidate and a political party's governing body, based on the assumption that the primary process was fair and even-handed, and the true facts were concealed from them. Because behind the scenes, the DNC was being anything but fair and even-handed in connection with the primary. So in that sense, I think we have more than enough material for a uniform omissions theory of class certification. But again, I submit that it's premature to even be discussing those issues at these stages. And the court asked the question about jurisdiction. I recently dealt with that issue, but it was in the Ninth Circuit. And if my recollection serves me well, The question of jurisdiction is determined at the time that the complaint is filed, and makes the allegations that invoke CAFA jurisdiction, which is what we've done in this case. So, and this was in the context of a court then subsequently denying class certification in a written order, and at the same time recognizing that the case still had jurisdiction under CAFA in that court, notwithstanding the class certification motion having been denied. So, if that principle also holds in the 11th Circuit, and I haven't looked at that issue, then I would submit that the court still would have jurisdiction, regardless of where the particular plaintiffs live, because CAFA jurisdiction was properly invoked in the original complaint. And finally, there's a thread that runs throughout the defendant's arguments, which suggests that by conducting this as a class action, there will be rampant violations of people's rights to association, because they, by virtue of how the classes are defined, they will be swept into a lawsuit that alleges claims which either they disagree with or, for whatever reason, they may not want to have any part of. Rule 23, as this court knows well, is a very flexible rule that contains mechanisms for addressing just those types of issues that someone doesn't have to be dragged into a lawsuit that they want no part of. There are opt-out mechanisms. There are notification mechanisms. There are issues relating to how the class could be defined. There are issues relating to the formation of subclasses. In connection with some of the choice of law issues that we've discussed, those can be handled through those Rule 23 mechanisms. So I just don't think those are valid concerns that the defendant has raised. But again, I would stress that I really think that the court would, and the parties would, benefit most by having a chance to conduct discovery and fully brief a formal motion for class certification before any of the issues that have been raised by defendant in connection with this aspect of their motion are decided by the court. The court. All right. Thank you, counsel. Now I have some questions for the plaintiffs regarding the class action allegations. And you've answered one of them already regarding what were to happen if the court were to strike the class allegations. My next question, well, actually my first question for the plaintiff is, are each of the plaintiffs diverse in citizenship from each of the defendants? Mr. Beck, Your Honor, I'm just going to grab a copy of the complaint. The court, no, take your time, and consult if you need to. Mr. Beck, if I may. The court, we're not going anywhere. Discussion had off the record between counsel. Mr. Spiva, I definitely don't mean to interrupt, Your Honor, but I actually have the answer to this now if the court. Well, you can step over and talk with counsel. I mean, that's Mr. Beck, sure. Discussion had off the record between counsel. Mr. Beck. Yes. Counsel has informed me, and it is indeed the case, that paragraphs 55 and 87 are, they're related to plaintiffs who live in the district. So those plaintiffs would not be diverse because the DNC is a member or a resident of the district. The court. And where might the court find the allegation of citizenship for Deborah Wasserman Schultz? Discussion had off the record between counsel. Mr. Beck. Paragraph 154 is the paragraph which speaks to the Congresswoman and specifies that she maintains offices in Pembroke Pines in the District of Columbia. However, I'm looking at this now, and it doesn't appear to contain an allegation relating to her. The court. Citizenship. Mr. Beck. Correct, I would agree with that. The court. That's fine, that's all right. My next question for the plaintiff is, are there Bernie Sanders donors who would not have standing to participate in this lawsuit? Mr. Beck. I can't think, as I sit here now, why any Bernie Sanders donor would not have standing to participate. The court. All right. Would a Bernie Sanders supporter who donated to Senator Sanders' campaign because of the DNC's alleged bias have standing? Mr. Beck. A Bernie Sanders donor who donated to the Bernie Sanders campaign. The court. Campaign. Mr. Beck. Yes, they would have standing. To the Bernie Sanders campaign, yes, they would have standing. Oh, the question is, because of the DNC's alleged bias. I think this gets into some issues in terms of how the defendant has framed our allegations. And of course, they have this footnote in... First of all, I don't see how a donor to the Bernie Sanders campaign would be in a position to have the knowledge that the DNC was predetermining the outcome for Hillary Clinton in the way that the complaint alleges. I think that certainly there was campaign rhetoric throughout the campaign, and I would not deny this, that there was a sense and a feeling through the process that it was unfair and that it was slanted. That said, I think there were orders of magnitude at issue in this case, which take this out of the realm of, you know, I just don't see how a Bernie Sanders campaign, a Bernie Sanders donor would have the knowledge to know that the DNC had predetermined the result for Hillary Clinton, number one. And number two, it just doesn't make sense to me why somebody would participate in a political process by paying money into the process when they knew that that process was rigged from the start, which is what we're alleging. I mean, that's what we're alleging in this complaint. The court. Sure. Mr. Beck. It just doesn't seem like a plausible position to be in at the same time we're having this exchange in the context of not having conducted discovery. And just on the basis of the four corners of a complaint, as I think is called for given the motion that the defendants have filed. I guess it's hard to imagine that situation given the state of the record at this point. Discussion had off the record between counsel. The court. Are there DNC donors who would not have standing to participate in this lawsuit? Mr. Beck. Again, I think fundamentally, people give money to candidates and political parties because they believe that we have a fair democratic process. And I think that that's a baseline assumption whenever a donation is made. I think if it's proven that the process is not what people believe it to be, then I think we've alleged standing on the basis of a false understanding that's been created by the defendants. And so again, I would think that all DNC donors have standing, because I believe that people, when people participate in the process in this way, and they actually write a check to a party or to a candidate, they believe that the process is fundamentally fair and democratic. The court. Would a person who donated to the DNC without reading the DNC's charter, or hearing the statements described in paragraph 160 of the First Amended Complaint, have standing? Mr. Beck. Yes. I think that a person in that situation would have standing. I think that this is a case that ultimately and probably for many and many people in the classes, as we've defined them in this complaint, this is a case of omission and concealment of what was actually going on behind the scenes at the DNC. And so I don't think a person necessarily has to read a news article where the DNC is specifically proclaiming its neutrality. Or I don't think a person has to read the charter itself. I think that there's a fundamental understanding in this country that's taught from a very early age, certainly I remember it, that we live in a democracy. And I think a fundamental part of what a democracy means is that elections are not conducted in this biased and predetermined way. And I think that everybody who seeks to participate in the political process, especially when they're going to the trouble of cutting a check to a candidate that they support or a party that they support, they believe that those candidates and entities are taking place in a process that is fair and impartial, because they believe in a process that's democratic. So I don't think someone necessarily needs to read the articles we've cited, or the charter, to be in the class of people that have been defrauded or deceived, or unjustly treated in terms of the unjust enrichment claim by the DNC's conduct. The court. Are there registered members of the Democratic Party who would not have standing to participate in this lawsuit? And maybe your last answer would be the same. Mr. Beck. Yeah, I think that's a similar answer to the previous question. I think, again, if there is, indeed, a fiduciary duty owed from the leadership of a party to the party's members, as we maintain in this case, then the DNC doesn't just abuse that relationship when it favors... It doesn't just abuse its relationship with its members who are Bernie Sanders supporters. It abuses the relationship with all of its members, because it's ultimately not acting according to what its charter requires it to do, and I would submit, according to what its position in this society as a trustee of our democratic institutions requires it to do. And so I think in the long run it hurts everybody in the party. And you know, that may involve some factual issues that are not appropriately at issue before the court right now,